May it please the court, I'm Richard S. Strauss, attorney registration number 7916 of the law firm of Silver and Dubosky, appearing on behalf of the appellant. Mr. Goodwin is also present in the courtroom. So may it please the court, counsel. This case is sort of a bar exam question on personal jurisdiction and due process of law, and what happens when a foreign state tries to exercise jurisdiction over a non-domiciliary of that state. Since 1945, when the U.S. Supreme Court announced International Shoe versus Washington, the hallmark of due process has been widely understood to be that a foreign jurisdiction cannot exercise personal jurisdiction over a non-domiciliary unless that non-domiciliary has sufficient minimum contacts with the foreign state so that it would not offend, quote, traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. It has long been established as well that due process of law requires, at a minimum, notice and reasonable opportunity to be heard. In this matter, the problem with what occurred in the Los Angeles County Superior Court and what occurred in the Denver District Court was that there was never a record developed about the minimum contacts that Mr. Goodwin may or may not have had with the state of California. The court in California, through a commissioner, which is comparable to a magistrate or referee in Colorado, entered an ex parte order based upon an ex parte unsworn declaration of a man named Jonathan Turco to establish the fact that, that Mr. Goodwin could not be reasonably located despite reasonable efforts of the plaintiff, and therefore alternative or substituted service over him would be proper. There's a couple of problems with that, in that in Mr. Turco's affidavit and in a subsequent affidavit filed by a woman named Lon View, who was also an attorney in a law firm that was representing the plaintiffs in the California defamation suit, both of them identified that they had used a service called Who Is, which I had never heard of, but apparently it's fairly wide known among people looking on the internet. And Who is a service that anybody can access. You put in an IP address and it tells you, it gives you a physical address for where that IP address is located. And Ms. View's declaration and also Mr. Turco's declaration, they indicated that they had used the service to trace down certain IP addresses that they attributed to the defendant. But they didn't use it to trace down an IP address that they had obtained for an account that they believed was owned by Mr. Goodwin with Twitter. And had they done the Who Is search on the IP address with the Twitter account, they would have discovered that that IP address was run through Comcast in Aurora, Colorado.
Well, let me ask you that, Mr. Strauss. I mean, my memory is Comcast is based in New Jersey. I mean, so or maybe it's in Pennsylvania. My concern is, and I hear your argument, so they could have done this, they could have done something else. I mean, is that the proper test that the court was facing? I mean, the question, I think, was reasonable diligence. And they put on, you know, at least there was some evidence introduced, hired investigators, we served subpoenas on ISPs, we did, you know, whatever other things, you know, just social networks, I guess it was. Why isn't this just a matter for the trial court to decide? I think this was reasonably diligent. I think you could, you know, a very fine lawyer like yourself could always come up with something else that could have done, and that the argument feels a little like that to me. So, you know, push back, and I'm interested in your response.
Well, I guess the problem that I had with what they did was that they stopped. They ran a Who Is search for some of the IP addresses that they located, but they didn't do them for all. And I understand the court's question and the court's concern, but the, in order to fall back to the least likely method of giving a defendant notice of the commencement of an action being publication in a newspaper, I think that there's more required than simply stopping in the middle and not taking the evidence or the information that you've been given and following it all the way to its conclusion. And they did not do that. But that's not the only thing.
Let me ask you a question. I think this is what Judge Gabriel was getting at. What is our standard of review for that? The court in California found that they used reasonable diligence. That's a finding of fact, isn't it? Based on all these circumstances that you just outlined, the court found reasonable diligence. Well, we would have to say what? That that's clearly erroneous?
Well, the court, I think the standard of review would be clearly erroneous, but the problem is the California court, there was an order entered that did not have specific findings of fact, and there was an inference that reasonable efforts had been made, but it was not I didn't read anything in the commissioner's order that indicated that that was an actual finding of fact. It was based upon ex parte unsworn statements of an investigator. So it wasn't even based on real evidence. So, but that's not, that was probably, if anything, the least of the concerns about what the California court did. The bigger concern was, even if it was not of an abuse of discretion or was not clearly erroneous for them to find that reasonable efforts had been exerted to locate Mr. Goodwin, the worst problem was ordering service by publication in the Los Angeles Times. There was absolutely no evidence presented by Mr. Churko or by the plaintiffs in any other pleading or motion that was filed with the California court to indicate that there was any reason to believe that Mr. Goodwin had ever been in Los Angeles. The only information that was presented to the court in LA was that at one point in time, Mr. Goodwin may have been located in San Francisco because his name was listed as the registered agent for an entity called Barr Partners, which was based in San Francisco. So if the court, there was no evidence presented by anybody that Mr. Goodwin was ever anywhere in California other than perhaps in San Francisco, and in Mr. Churko's affidavit, he details the fact that they tried to locate him at the address in San Francisco, and it wasn't a valid address. So there wasn't even any real evidence that he was in California, even in San Francisco.
What does the California statute require with respect to service by publication?
It requires that the publication occur in a publication of general circulation that's most likely to give the defendant notice of the pendency of the action.
And the LA Times is certainly a newspaper of general circulation.
It is.
And how do you decide whether it's most likely?
Well, I think, I don't know if you can decide whether it's most likely. I think it would be more likely if it was a newspaper in San Francisco, but it's completely unlikely that he would see it in the LA Times unless there was something presented to the trial court out there that indicated that he had ever been in LA. There was no information that he had ever been in Los Angeles. The third problem.
Mr. Strauss, before you get to that, I want to make sure I ask you a question, and I think you may not get to, so I want to make sure.
Okay.
Would you address this time bar issue that Mr. Bauman raises? I understand your argument, but is there no deadline on a defendant's ability to collaterally attack another state's judgment in a different jurisdiction? We know that it would be too late to go to California and challenge a judgment. Does a party in your client's position have forever to challenge the judgment someplace else?
No, I don't think that's what we're saying. But first of all, I wanted to point out to the court the case of Sternbach versus Buck that was cited in our reply brief, in which the California courts have enunciated the same rule that we have in Colorado under Rule 60, which is that you may be time barred from filing a motion to set aside the judgment, but you're not time barred from filing an independent action. And I think if the judgment is void, I think it can be collaterally attacked for lack of jurisdiction really at any point in time, but even in Colorado under Rule 60, it would not have been time, it's not time barred here, because under Rule 60, if you're under the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, if you're going to collaterally attack a judgment that's being brought to Colorado for the purposes of enforcement, the rules, Rule 60 applies to that proceeding in terms of the defendant being able to challenge the judgment. And under Rule 60, the motion in Colorado would have to be brought within a reasonable time under Rule 60B. And clearly here, the judgment was brought to Colorado in January of 2014. And it was challenged as soon as Mr. Goodwin found out about it in March of 2014. So I think even under Rule 60, that's clearly a reasonable time.
I apologize for getting you off track, but I wanted to hear what you would say on that. Thank you.
I was hoping to get to that point, but wasn't sure if I
did. Mr. Goodwin file an affidavit that he became aware of the judgment in October 2011?
Mr. Goodwin found out about the judgment in October of 2011 when he received a communication from Twitter that it had been served with this order from the California
court. But he didn't file anything until 2014.
He didn't file anything.
2.5 years later.
That's correct, Your Honor. He did not file anything in California, but he didn't really have a reason to do that unless or until they were seeking to enforce it against him in Colorado. And he did challenge it within a reasonable time after being notified that they were trying to collect their judgment. The real issue is, that would be, it seems to me, maybe a latches argument, but it wouldn't make a time bar.
If 60B says a reasonable amount of time, that's an open-ended decision. But 2.5 years might be found not to be a reasonable amount of time when a person knows they have a judgment against them, whether it's enforced or not.
Well, you wouldn't be challenging the judgment in Colorado unless or until they were trying to domesticate it in Colorado. So a reasonable time for him to go to California and try to have the judgment set aside there, that's a different question, I think, than a reasonable time for him to collaterally attack the judgment in the state of Colorado.
Okay.
So we have the two issues of not diligent efforts to locate Mr. Goodwin, and no evidence to support any sort of finding that the LA Times would be the most likely publication to give him notice of the proceedings. But then there's the third part, which I think is the most fatal to this judgment, which is neither the California court nor the district court in Denver made any findings about why the exercise of jurisdiction by the state of California over Mr. Goodwin would not offend traditional notions of due process and fairness and substantial justice. Mr. Goodwin did not do business in the state of California. There was no evidence, no actual evidence, other than an unsworn declaration that Mr. Goodwin even posted any these allegedly defamatory statements onto a blog or onto some other sort of website. The only evidence, or the only information, I should say, which doesn't rise to the level of evidence, that was presented to the court in California was that these postings were made to a blog, and Mr. Turco stated in his declaration that upon information and belief, Mr. Goodwin owned the website, owned the blog. There was no evidence that he actually posted anything to anywhere. And furthermore, the law in California, there isn't any law in Colorado on it, the law in California is that posting to a passive website is not sufficient minimum context with the state so that the exercise of jurisdiction based upon that would be reasonable. And that's both the Jewish Defense Organization case and the Pavlovich case that we cited in our brief. and there isn't any Colorado law on it, nor is there any contrary law that says that it could be posting to a passive website where somebody else actually has to take an affirmative act to look up what's on that blog. There isn't any law that I was able to locate that says that in and of itself is sufficient to, for a state to exercise personal jurisdiction.
And I know your time's about up here, Mr. Strauss, but what about all the cases that deal with the effects test? I mean, you can post to a passive blog, but intentionally intend to go after somebody in California, say, in this case, and that's what the other side's argument is. You know, that these defamatory statements were attacking an individual with very egregious statements about the individual and a law firm in California. Who else is that going to impact but somebody in California?
But the crux of a defamation suit, Your Honor, is it doesn't have to be communicated to someone. And if you're just simply posting it onto a passive website, there isn't any evidence that that was ever communicated to anybody.
Thank you, Mr. Strauss.
Thank you.
I was wanting to reserve some time for rebuttal, but next time.
Thank you, Mr. Strauss.
You're not the first one that's happened to.
I'm sure that has.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Fred Bauman, registration number 12156, and I represent the appellees Marsha Hatch and the Gunderson Dettmer Law Firm. This case really is about Article 4, Section 1 of the United States Constitution, which states that the judicial orders of one state must be given full faith and credit in all the sister states. That's been true since 1963 when the U.S. Supreme Court issued its Durfee case, and it's been recognized repeatedly in this state and elsewhere. The full faith and credit clause prohibits exactly what the defendant, the appellant, is trying to do here, collaterally attack a judgment entered by a sister state. In our Uniform Foreign Judgments Act, Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, codified here at 1353-103, a judgment authenticated in the manner required by this state, like happened here, is to be given, and I'm quoting, the same effect as a judgment of the court of this state in which it is filed, that is to say, Colorado. In Marworth, the Colorado Supreme Court recognized that the Uniform Foreign Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Acts really effectuates the full faith and credit clause in the Constitution. There, the court recognized that this court and the court below were required to give a judgment at least the res judicata effect which the judgment would be accorded in the state which rendered it. So what does that mean here? This state must enforce the Los Angeles Superior Court judgment to the same extent that the courts in California were required to do so. As Chief Judge Martinez found below, and as the record makes clear, Mr. Goodwin has not even come close to meeting his heavy burden to show that the court erred in denying the Rule 60b-3 motion. Let me say something first about standard of review and burden of proof. It's raised in part by Judge Richman. The review of a determination under Rule 60b-3 is a review made by this court de novo. However, Mr. Goodwin has, under 60b-3, the burden of demonstrating his entitlement to relief by clear and convincing evidence. Moreover, since the constitutional question here is at best a mixed one of law and fact, the factual determinations that underlie the finding of service and the finding of jurisdiction are entitled to the traditional deference given to a fact finder in the courts of this state and the courts in California, not clearly erroneous. I almost thought I heard, well, I'll go back and look at the tape, Mr. Strauss concede that the determination of whether in fact the service, the record on service in front of the court in California was sufficient is entitled to a not clearly erroneous standard on appeal. If so,
I think he did say that in response to my question.
I thought so too.
Okay.
I'm glad we're in agreement on that.
But he's saying that it was a clear error because they didn't really look into the mode of service. And that, and also he's saying, and I'm a little confused about this, he's saying that the information put before the if it was called a referee or the magistrate, wasn't sworn. It was no actual admissible evidence. Were these statements sworn as statements or just unsigned?
In California practice, there are declarations submitted by lawyers which have the same effect in California as a affidavit would in this state.
They don't get to swear to them because they're already members of the
bar. They're members of the bar and they declare. Now, the record in front of the court in California consisted of the affidavit, the complaint, obviously, the affidavit of Ms. Hatch as to the effects of the conduct of Mr. Goodwin on her, as well as the detailed affidavits of the steps that were taken by Ms. Hatch and the Gunderson-Dentmer firm to attempt to locate Mr. Goodwin. The question, and it is a question of California law, I think everyone concedes that, is whether the evidence is sufficient to support the finding by the judge in Los Angeles that the defendant could not, with reasonable diligence, be served in an ordinary way. And that then requires or authorizes alternative service, same as it would happen here.
So, Mr. Bauman, just to make sure I understand you, do you think the record does show a clear finding of fact that the plaintiffs undertook reasonably diligent efforts to serve the defendant?
I do, and it's found in the order for publication of summons in the record at pages 58 through 61. This is the result of the Turco affidavit and the other information presented, admittedly ex parte, because it's a default judgment situation, to the referee or commissioner. You got me. It's a commissioner in Los Angeles. That order, at its second page, says, and I quote, based upon the ex parte application and the supporting evidence, it appears to the satisfaction of the court that defendant Goodwin cannot be served with reasonable diligence in any other manner set forth in the Code of Civil Procedure, and it goes on. That's a fact finding. That is a finding that the evidence in front of the commissioner was sufficient to enable him to make the determination required by California statute. It also goes on to say, this gets to the second point of the appellant's argument, that the newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, is authorizing that service, was the newspaper most likely to give actual notice to the defendant Goodwin, and it required publication for four consecutive weeks. That too is a fact finding. It's a finding by the judge that the Los Angeles Times is in fact the newspaper most likely to give actual notice to the defendant.
Well, let me ask you about that if I can, Mr. Redding. I caught you mid-syllable, I apologize.
That's okay.
Let me ask you about that finding, because I will concede that's the issue that troubles me the most about your argument. I think it's in your briefs and in other places. You yourself said the information you had suggested that there was some connection here, maybe in San Francisco, New York, or New Zealand, if I recall. So how do we get to the Los Angeles Times from that?
It's a matter, Judge Gabriel, of California statute. California alternative service statute only permits alternative service in a newspaper of general jurisdiction published in the state of California. The determination then was limited. Determination by the commissioner under that statute is limited to which of the available California newspapers I'm going to choose. The Los Angeles Times was at the time the fourth highest circulation newspaper in the U.S. It had a substantial internet presence, including national, more so than the San Francisco Chronicle or wherever competing papers were. And again, in the exercise of that judge's discretion, he concluded that that was the right vehicle for publication under California law. But he went further. At our client's request, we also asked him to direct us as part of this alternative publication to try to contact Mr. Goodwin through some of the other media that Mr. Goodwin had used, blog postings, some websites associated with him. And the court actually said, again, in the order for publication of summons, it directed us to try to use those other vehicles, and it said if defendant Goodwin's address is ascertained prior to the expiration of the time prescribed for publication, a copy shall immediately be mailed to him. In other words, keep trying to find him through these other media. If you do, serve him through normal process, give him actual notice. If not, we're going down the publication path. That's exactly what California law prescribes, and it is perfectly consistent with all the due process that Mr. Bruton is entitled to. I also would ask you to look closely at his affidavits, because I believe, and I know my clients believe, that in fact he did have notice of this, the institution of the Los Angeles lawsuit before it entered, judgment entered, because he says in his affidavit, they sent postings to websites I was associated with. He concedes there were websites he was associated with. He never once says, I didn't know. This was his chance to have said so. Let me talk briefly about the jurisdictional issue, and then I'll try to address the timing issue as well. I think jurisdiction is an easy question here. In Calder, the U.S. Supreme Court modified, if you will, the international shoe test in the context of torts that are committed outside of the jurisdiction with an impact, clear impact, in a jurisdiction. In Calder, like here, a defamation case, Florida-based defendants made defamatory comments about a California-based resident, Shirley Jones, the actress. She brought suit in California, and the question went all the way up to the Supreme Court, unanimously deciding that, in fact, where the effect of the defendant's conduct is targeted at the jurisdiction, then, in fact, it does not violate due process to require that otherwise non-resident defendant to defend his or her conduct in the state. That's what happened here. It is absolutely true, if you look at any of the material in the record that were the basis of the defamation case, that the defamatory statements were of and concerning a targeted California woman, my client Marcia Hatch, and her law firm, Gunderson Dettler. The clearest example of that is the open letter to Marcia Hatch that was posted on the website, and it's included in the record in this case, it's attached to the complaint. It starts off by saying this is a letter to Marcia Hatch from John Goodwin with her address in California, her office phone number, her personal phone number, her fax, her mobile phone in California. That is exactly what the Supreme Court was talking about in Calder when it said, where you target a defendant, a resident of the state, it is not constitutionally unreasonable to defend, to require that out-of-state defendant to defend in the state. Pavlovich, one of the two cases, California cases, relied upon by Mr. Strauss, is easily distinguishable. In Pavlovich, the court noted that if, in fact, the defendant expressly aimed the tortious conduct at California, then jurisdiction would be proper. In that case, the court found that the defendant had no way of knowing that its wrongful conduct was going to be harmful for a California defendant, and therefore the court said, that's not enough. But if you expressly target, that would be enough. Jewish Defense Organization actually is even more easily distinguishable because there the suit was brought in California between two parties who had no contact at all with California. They were New York residents, I believe. And the court concluded that the bulk of the harm would be found where the plaintiff was domiciled, which in that case was New York, not California, so they refused to entertain jurisdiction. Here the plaintiffs, both the law firm and the individual plaintiff, are indisputably residents of California. Let me briefly address the time bar question. In Marworth, the Supreme Court noted, as I said before, that in this state we are required to give this judgment the same res judicata effect it would have in California. California would not entertain the motion that was filed here because it was filed more than 2 years after the default judgment was entered. That's also the rule, by the way, that's reflected in the restatement second of conflicts. It would make sense to determine the timeliness of any challenge to jurisdiction under the law of the jurisdiction which issued the judgment, rather than allow 49 other jurisdictions and the District of Columbia to pick and choose how it wanted to deal with collateral attacks on California judgments.
Mr. Bauman? What do you do with the language from some of the cases, including from this court, would say that while the court, when a court is asked to enforce the judgment of a sister state, that court always has the power to inquire into the jurisdiction of the foreign court to issue the judgment.
I think there's no question the court not only has the power, but the authority, but is obligated to inquire into jurisdiction. But inquire into and second guess are two different things. Inquire into is merely to make sure that the judgment issued in California was issued in accordance with California processes and procedures, and is comports with fundamental principles of due process that underlie notice, opportunity to be heard.
So that due process inquiry would not be barred by any state limitation on collateral attack, would it?
It depends on the procedural vehicle. Under 60B3 in this state, it's a reasonable period of time, not a bar. In California, it's 473.2 of their code. It's a two-year bar. State is entitled to place its own reasonable restrictions. I submit that it would be absurd for the jurisdiction to be subject to collateral attack here in Colorado based upon a claim that it is void for lack of due process, which is what the claim is here, when it is not subject to that same challenge in California, which issued it. The principle should not be least common denominator. It should be determined by the law of the jurisdiction that issued the judgment.
Thank you.
Unless the court had any further questions, we would ask that we confirm both on the merits of the constitutional issue and the claim being timely. Thank you very much.
Before Judge Navarro wraps up, I just want to make a comment, and people who know me have seen me do this. I care very deeply about professionalism, and we sometimes see conduct that's less than professional. It is a delight to see professional conduct in this courtroom. Goodness knows this case is contentious. It was a pleasure to read briefs that were not personally attacking each side. They were very well done. The arguments here I found exceptionally professional. I'm glad there are a bunch of people here that have had the chance to see them. I personally, I think I speak for my colleagues, appreciate the incredible professionalism of both counsel. I'm not surprised, I know you both, but it's very nice to see, and I personally thank both of you.
I appreciate that.
Thank you, Judge.
We also join in Judge Gabriel's comments. Thank you very much both for your fine arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. We will now take a short recess to reconstitute the panel before our next case.